Thank you, Mr. Pavlik, and good afternoon to you all. We have several visitors today, so welcome to everyone. We certainly have a full house, represented very substantially by the Henderson dynasty. It's good to see everybody here from all over. So some we haven't seen for a time, but good to make reconnections again. Others of visitors are in the area too, so welcome to you all, and good to have you here with us today. Bring greetings from the Youngstown congregation this morning as well. This was our second week of the new blended congregation of Youngstown and Meadville together. So they were celebrating with a little bit of a meal together, which my wife and I inhaled and ran for the door, which is pretty much the way things work. And they said, don't worry about it. The Myerses did the same thing all the time. So, but one thing my wife has noticed is when we get to where we're going, she says, "Are we here already?" It's a little shorter drive than it has been for the last 16 years, but it is further for some of the brethren from the Erie area, so please do keep them in your prayers too. That's a real challenge for them as well. Well, today, as we all know well, is God's special day. Not an annual one in this case, but the weekly Sabbath. But it's also holy time. And there is no difference between holy time on an annual basis or holy time on a weekly basis. And the very idea of holy time is a foreign concept to the vast majority of people who profess and believe that they are Christians. The most common belief that I've come across in studying and talking with different ones as well, the most articulated statement is that, well, the time that we dedicate to God in worship, that's holy time. The only problem with that is it turns things upside down, doesn't it? Who is it that can designate what's holy and what's not holy? Not our actions, but instead it's God who identifies and says, this is my time, this is the period of time that I have put my presence in. And he invites us to share it, but we're not the one to determine that. Now, how did all this come to be? How did things get so upside down in the common view of those who mean well and profess to be followers of Jesus Christ in this case? I think we're all familiar with the account in the book of Genesis. I'm not going to turn there, but the early chapters of the book of Genesis describe just how and where our world began to go off track. And sadly, it was pretty near the beginning of things, as we all understand. We know who the original instigator of the trouble was and continues to be. But that's also a figure of fun to many people. The idea of a literal devil is viewed as archaic, medieval, and just not up with the times. Unfortunately, that's not the reality from the perspective we're looking at. If only it could be that simple. And of course, in a couple of weeks, so many around us will be celebrating a holiday that seems to have taken a turn toward the demonic. I don't know, when I was a kid, before my family came into the Church of God, we kept, I was 8 years old, so I remember keeping some Halloweens, but you know, it was a big deal. Let's see, am I going to go as Superman or Roy Rogers this year? You know, seems to have been a lot simpler age and a little more gentle a concept of things. Not that I wasn't begging for candy all night long, I was, but that's still the same premise, I think, wherever you go. And kept our dentist with a continually growing client list, I guess. But all of that brings us really to where we are today and with the complications that we've seen, to where our world finds itself. It's still under the sway of what Paul identified, the being Paul identified in 2 Corinthians 4 as the God of this world, or the God of this age, Satan. No, he can't win. In the end, God's plan will triumph simply because he is the one who has the most control and power over everything and can set the agenda, if I can put it that way. And yes, Satan and his demons will be restrained as we go forward. But you know, there's another verse that lately just seems to keep popping into my head, and it's one from the book of Daniel in chapter 7. It's part of a prophecy of a future attempt once more to be a demagogic world ruling power. It's an outgrowth of the ancient Roman Empire, through its various iterations, resurrections, if you want to call it that. And as it looks ahead to the future, it talks about this fourth beast, it says in verse 23, but the description is in verse 25. One of these outstandingly outspoken pompous rulers says, he will speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. The familiar 3.5 year refrain that we identify with the 3.5 years before Jesus Christ returns. The word persecute in the New King James, I have a marginal reference in my Bible, and it says that in Hebrew it literally means to wear out. To wear out. Now, I don't know about you, but that keeps popping into my head when I just survey the world scene and the different trends and directions and the way we seem to be going. And it just seems to be exhausting all the time in so many ways. I don't think it's Mr. Slagle alone who needs a nap before the end of the day. Though he may be the, you know, the reigning champion of the afternoon nap, I have no idea. Oh, his wife is agreeing, so okay, we should check. You may want to, two of you, talk afterwards and sort this out. But at any rate, the concept of just wearing out, I think, resonates with a lot of people, perhaps with you too. I was thinking along those lines the other day, and I came to a certain conclusion about the effect of the coronavirus pandemic, since we've been familiar with it now for well over a year and a half. 2 years ago, if you'd said those words, we'd have probably had to look it up in a medical dictionary. But now we're all familiar. And that seems to pretty well describe things. It's just wearying. It's wearying. You know, you sometimes if you pop on a television show or watch an old movie or something, and you say, oh, well, they had to have been filmed before this time because everybody's not wearing a mask, nobody thinks anything about it. And then you see an ad that's a little more current, but then it's changed again because things have gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's just wearying. And I think sometimes people just get flat out discouraged. Not all, but many. Some appear to be more the glass half full type of personality, and they just try to encourage and rally others. And that's great, and that's much appreciated. But after well more than a year and a half, I wonder if their numbers are dwindling. We thought it was all being brought under some kind of control. We seemed to be moving in the right direction back this past spring and into the summer. But then the Delta variant began to catch hold. And being of a strange analytical mindset, the first thing that came to my mind is, what happened to Alpha, Beta, and Gamma? And of course, the answer is they were also variants, but they just weren't dangerous ones. And so they basically disappeared and didn't cause any problem. The fourth one out of the box, Delta, not so good. I don't want to be... this is a rain on the parade type day message, isn't it? I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but in Latin America, they're battling in some areas the Mu variant. I don't even know how many letters are between Delta and Mu in the Greek alphabet. I'm not sure I want to at the moment. But those are all descriptions of things that are happening in our world. The numbers of people that you see that are affected, whose discouragement, sometimes it voices itself in antisocial behavior and even rage, which is even sadder. But there are restless and downhearted and discouraged, and the numbers are growing. And of course, there are those in our world, about 4 million or more, who have died or have had difficult times with the illness, even though they eventually recovered. What lasting effects may still be hard for them and difficult for them to battle remains to be seen. We're hearing a number of and series of prayer requests, as you know, in the last few weeks. Those descriptions do speak to a number in the Church of God. If you watched In Accord that Mr. Franks presented this past week, he specifically opened by asking us to keep in our prayers those who are still struggling with and still suffering from the COVID virus. There are a number of congregations that are still not meeting this week because of large numbers. As I think you all realize, most of you here know that the Cleveland congregation seemed to have its situation to deal with before the feast. We had a couple of Sabbaths where our attendance was literally less than half the number on the books. We didn't have to cancel, but we had a lot lower attendances than usual right before the feast. So these are all things to keep in mind. But let me ask you a question in all of this. I've talked about the church. I've talked about the world, meaning those not similarly called by God, John 6:44. Which group do you think would be the main target of the resentment and vengeful approach of the adversary? Now, you might say, well, he'd be angry at any human beings. And on one level, that's true. Because human beings are created, we know from Genesis, in the image of God. We know that the potential of every human being who has ever lived or will ever live is to be given the opportunity to understand and access the things of God, the knowledge of God, to have a mind opened by a miraculous intervention, like John 6:44 alludes to and describes. And in that sense, everyone is a threat to him. But at the moment, that's not where the world is right now. That doesn't describe what's happening at this moment as God's plan unfolds and develops. Right now, Jesus' own comments in Luke 12, where he talked about the church as being a little flock, apply a lot more, because the numbers are minuscule compared to the world population, which is now approaching 8 billion, somewhere around 7.8, close to 7.9. Is it those not yet called that Satan is targeting? Is it those not yet converted? Is it those not yet given the miracle of John 6, verse 44? I don't think so. Them he has for the moment. For the moment, and I would stress that, it's temporary because it won't last. You heard a reference in the earlier message to the second resurrection. That will be the answer for most. The time of understanding. But who is it that he would really like to mire in the depths of despair, if we're talking about that, to remove courage from? You ever analyze the word discourage? That's all it means. Discourage. Remove courage. We should know the answer, brethren, who he's targeting and who would be his favorite victory. And we should be on guard. There is a prophecy of the future that gives us a little preview of how he thinks and what he plans to do. It's in Revelation 12. Revelation chapter 12. And verse 13. It says, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, this is inserting into the middle of a prophetic tapestry that's being woven, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. There are a lot of metaphors in there. I think we can pick up most of them. The church representing, the woman representing God's church, the male child, a specific reference to Jesus Christ, but these are broader terms as we look at it. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time. There's that prophetic reference again, 3.5 years. From the presence of the serpent. And again, following a lot of metaphors, the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman. It doesn't say it was literal water. It says he spewed water that was like a flood. A pursuing army? Who knows? We don't know. Possibility. That he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman. We're not talking about animism here. We're not talking about worshiping the creation. This is just a metaphor that God intervenes by causing a miraculous geophysical event of some kind. The earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Interesting prophecy, an interesting description. It is a prophecy for the future. Our guess would be that there is a time coming when God will have to supernaturally intervene to actually protect his called and chosen saints, those who are converted and striving to develop the character of Jesus Christ and become like their elder brother just before the return of Jesus Christ. But that there will be some who will not be included in that number, who are yet God's people, but perhaps not as on fire for the truth as they should be, or as close to God, and they're, in a sense, given a terrible chance to get closer to God through tribulation. But the bottom line is, I'm looking at Satan's reaction today, trying to analyze. To tell the truth, I don't think he would turn up his nose at trying to trip some of God's people up, no matter what the circumstances, what the situation, here, now, past, present, future. I don't think he has that kind of scruples in his conscience. But I also think he's aware of something. I believe Satan is aware to some degree of John 6 and verse 44. We find a reference in the New Testament to the fact that it says that, do you believe? There's a reference. And then the question is, but don't you understand that even Satan and the demons believe and they tremble? So he has some understanding of things. It's clear that some things are hidden. You go through some of the examples, even the way he orchestrated the death of Jesus Christ by, and in effect played right into God's hands for the overall plan and purpose he had. A similar comment could be made about the example of Job, that he seemed unaware that he was also playing into God's hands for a difficult challenge and a kind of a purifying trial for a very righteous man. Ezekiel named him as one of three in the Old Testament, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, Ezekiel wrote in chapter 14. That's a pretty rarefied air to be in, pretty short list. And yet he was unaware. But I think he has some concept of the fact that God performs a miracle, opens a mind, and then those are the ones that challenge him the most. If he didn't have that concept, why would it say here in Revelation 12 that the dragon was enraged with the woman? Enraged. He was denied a conquest. Look through history. Look at the reactions of warlords and leaders of the past, whose sole goal in life is further conquering, for some of them. An anecdotal story about Alexander the Great says that when he realized he had conquered the known world, he sat down and cried because there were no lands left to conquer. It's hard to understand. Hard to understand. But it reflects something. It reflects a superior spirit being, but not a kind one, not a righteous one. This being is enraged when a portion of his target escapes. And he turns and focuses his attention on the others that he can still reach in some fashion and still torment. I also think he's capable of something else, and this is something I would like to have you think about. I believe that it's possible, because he plays mind games with human beings, I don't think he would avoid trying to turn the very certainty you and I have of the truth of God against us. Now you might say, well, what in the world do you mean by that? I mean, brethren, that as we spend time learning the way of God, studying his word, coming to understand what he requires of us, what he expects of us, and what his amazing offer and mercy and patience is with us, the more we get to know him in one sense, the more our minds do change and our pattern of thinking changes and we alter certain things. I would think, in this world are very much against the concept of, well, all opinions are of the same and equal value. They're not. They're not of the same value. The further they are from God's opinion, the less value they have. And the closer they are to his opinion and his truth and his word, Jesus said in that prayer in John 17, your word is truth. The closer they are to that, the more value and validity they have. But I think he can turn that against us. We've learned to think in a certain way, to be able to identify certain absolutes. We know there are things that are absolutely true based on this. We know there are things that are absolutely of good value based on this. We know there are things that are absolutely wrong based on this. So we get to thinking in terms of absolutes. It's not bad. I'm just saying it can be turned against us. Among those who are undiscerning, I think Satan would play on that thinking process. And I believe he would try everything he could to get us to apply that pattern of thinking we've learned to use since being called to things that are not certain. To things that are the things and the movements and the politics and the interests and the goals of this world. And to think of them in the same ways, absolutes. But they aren't absolutes. God's truth is absolute. His plan is absolute. There is no question of its success and his success. But if we learn to think in that pattern, not a bad thing when we apply it here. But if we lift it from here and transpose it into the world and society and cultures and values around us and tend to look for things in the same way and focus and line up behind them in the same way, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. Because this world doesn't have absolute truth and absolute value and absolute redemptive qualities. Not the way God's plan does. Not the way God's mind works. We have to be aware of things like that. Do you know what the result would be of that happening? Of God's called out ones, chosen ones, misappropriating the manner of thinking about truth and absolute, plunking it down onto the worldly values. The result is division in the church. Division in the body of Christ. Ungodly behavior toward others being one manifestation, there are others. And that, I believe, could be very discouraging to some of God's precious called out ones. We need to think about that. There seems to be a very effective tool that Satan is using right now across a broad spectrum of the lives of not just the people of God, but the whole world. But that's what we need to focus on, where we are. And that's not even the only source for the challenge to your spiritual health right now and to the time of sometimes discouragement. Sometimes the troubles just seem to pile up. We've heard a lot of prayer requests in the last few weeks, and it's disheartening, which is one of the other synonyms for discouraged. That's what I want to talk about today. Have you ever felt discouraged? I'm not talking about issues that involve organic difficulties and challenges medically. I'm not talking about clinical depression or some of those things. I'm just talking about just plain old discouragement. Have you ever felt that way? I'm sure we all have. We're all human. You ever feel just weighed down sometimes with cares? Staggering under a load you can barely identify, let alone shed? Wonder why God allowed this trial or that trial or other trial? Mr. Kevin Epps presented the Friday Night Live this week, and one statement he made really stuck with me. He was talking about, is God fair? That was his topic. And he made the statement, he says, if we ever, even once, ask ourselves the question, is God fair when he does this? He says, we better immediately engage in a self-examination. That's a point worth thinking about, isn't it? If we ever ask, is God fair, we better stop. Whoa, let's go back to the basics here. Time to do a little self-examination. Because where does that question come from? What was the very deceptive ploy that Satan used on Eve? Basically, didn't he say, is God fair? That's the oldest trick in the book. The oldest trick in the book. Be aware of it. You know, I think some of God's precious saints may be feeling or experiencing things like that these days. So let's look into it. Let's not run away from it. Let's look into it. Let's start with a dictionary. I don't expect you to write all these down because, let's see, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 30, 1, 2, 3, 4, 35. 35 synonyms along with a definition. If you can get these all down, you win the big prize. You can have 2 cups of coffee after services. Your mind will be working even faster after that, at a more rapid rate. Discourage, definition, to deprive of courage. That's not that hard, is it? To deprive of courage or confidence, to dishearten. Let me throw the synonyms at you now. Okay, I have to take a deep breath. I won't be able to get them all out in one breath, but we'll try. No, I won't. Synonyms, chill, daunt, demoralize, dishearten, dismay, dispirit, frustrate, unman, that's kind of dated, unnerve, throw cold water on. Then there are related words, browbeat, bully, cow, horse, just wanted to see if you were listening, just cow, intimidate, depress, sadden, weigh, afflict, try, damp, dampen, deaden, distress, trouble, bother, irk, vex, worry, debilitate, enfeeble, undermine, weaken, frighten, horrify, and scare. Did you get all those? But you did get the sense, didn't you? You do get the picture. You get the feeling. Have you ever felt any of that? Well, of course you have. We all have as human beings. How about now? How about in the last 18, 19 months? Well, first we need to figure out where it comes from. As I've said, Satan is certainly one source, no doubt the prime source, but he's only one. So let's take a look at some of them today and see what resources we have to battle this. Now, I want you to remember something as we begin. We have to be able to battle this, and one of the things we have to know is that probably not all of the opinions we hold are totally 100% accurate. That may be a shock to you, but it's true. If there's anyone for whom that's not true, don't put up your hand because you're going to get dirty looks from everybody else in the audience. We all have a folder in our mental filing cabinet. And that folder says how the world works. The only trouble is it's different from everybody else's folder. And it has the same name, the same title, How the World Works. Do you know what it really should be labeled? It should be labeled How I Tell Myself the World Works. How I Tell Myself the World Works. The trouble is, we think it's how the world works. Remember what I said earlier about learning to think in such an absolute way and getting it turned against us? That's what I'm talking about. So remember that that folder is in your mental filing cabinet. If it helps to say it's on your hard drive, fine. I'm trying to present graphic pictures here that are at least 50 years old. The one in your head needs to be relabeled. The one in my head needs to be relabeled. We need to tell ourselves it really should say how I tell myself the world works. Because the closer we get to Philippians 2:5 and the mind of Jesus Christ, the closer we get to being able to say now it really is accurate how the world works. First source, of course, as we've talked about, is from Satan's attacks. Yes, he's a prime source of discouragement. Why not? If he can get us to focus on anything but God's plan and purpose, he can trip us up. Anything but God's plan and purpose. That's all he needs. That accomplishes his purpose. It doesn't matter if we are entirely and wholeheartedly supportive of everything he says and does, as long as we mess up in enough important areas on God's way of thinking, we're in trouble. And sometimes he is allowed, for God's own reasons, to be very active in trying to do just that. Turn to the book of Job. I know this is a familiar example. And as we read it, remember something. Remember that reference that I alluded to from Ezekiel 14. when the analogy was being made about being responsible for our own actions and having the results from them. Ezekiel wrote, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, they would deliver only their own souls by their righteousness. They couldn't bring along anybody else on the influence of their coattails, as we used to say. Only up to them. In Job, the very first chapter, we find we have a picture here of a kind of a view of the spirit world that's rare in God's scriptures, but it gives us the knowledge that sometimes, for his own purposes, God allows Satan or the demons to come before his presence. He doesn't say why. He doesn't delineate exactly what the purpose is, but we can maybe deduce a little bit, play a little Sherlock Holmes and figure it out. It says in verse 6 of chapter 1, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Eternal. Obviously, we're talking angels. No humans are in heaven or ever have been. And before the Eternal, before the Lord, and Satan came among them, the adversary. The adversary. Again, Mr. Epps, Friday Night Live, dealt with that quite a bit. And the Eternal said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan, now ask yourself a question. Did God not know where Satan had come from? Of course he knew. He wanted to see what Satan would answer. He wanted to see what the approach would be. He wanted to see how he was going to try to twist this one. And so Satan answered and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." Now, that's not much of an answer, is it? It's kind of evasive. "Where you been?" "Oh, here and there. Up and down. Over and beyond." Oh, that's specific, huh? How was the weather in over and beyond? Then the Lord answered and said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" I think in the old King James it says, eschews evil. I kind of like that word, eschews. Sounds like you're working over some cashews or, never mind. But fears God and shuns evil. That's God's public assessment of his servant Job. Was God aware that Job was less than totally perfect, that he had issues that needed to be dealt with, character issues that needed to be kind of whetted and sharpened and honed and made more effective in God's service? Well, of course he did. But he wasn't going to tip his hand to Satan. And you know how the story goes. Job is, in a sense, delivered into Satan's hand. Satan says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? You've put a hedge around him, around his household, everything he has. You've blessed everything he's done. If you stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, he'll curse you to your face." Basically, Satan says, as long as you give him every advantage, of course he's going to be good. It's an interesting view into the spirit world. And so you go through the story and you know what happened. Sometimes there are remarkable things that God does allow, and we don't always have the full view of it up front. Job didn't have the full view up front, did he, at all? And yet, at least initially, his reaction was good. He lost everything in a matter of almost moments, it seems. By the time you come down to the end of chapter 1, though, when he has lost all of his possessions, all of his wealth, even his children, his reputation in some ways, his respect, it says in verse 20, he arose and tore his robe. That was an action of great sadness or anxiety or grief. And he shaved his head, same comment, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Eternal." That was his reaction. And that's pretty much what God told Satan he would do. Now things get more complex after that, as you know. Then he was struck personally. He had these horrible boils. I can't even imagine what that's like. When we were kids, my brother and I, my brother Dave had one, and I watched the agony that he wrestled with one boil. I don't think I'd want a whole body full of them. Everything is stripped away. His health is struck. But then, well, Job's three friends show up. And for a solid week, chapter 2 and verse 13, they say nothing. That was the wisest conversation they ever had. They didn't say a word. Because as soon as they began to open their mouths to try to answer Job, it all went off the rails. Job's first comment basically says, "I wish I were dead." Or, "I wish I had never lived." And he would change that by the end of the book. We know all that. But I'm just driving at something here. Because as soon as his three friends heard that, they opened up that mental filing cabinet and they took out that folder that says, "How the World Works." At least that's what they thought. What it really said was, "We have this all figured out. Here's how I tell myself the world works." And they never could convince Job, could they? You go through the whole book and it's back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Finally, after they've all exhausted themselves, a young man by the name of Elihu speaks up, and God never speaks to Elihu. He never corrects Elihu, the one who was closest to being on the mark. Job was human, of course. Clearly, he was not without sin, but he was judged as a righteous man enough to be listed by Ezekiel in a very short list of three. Maybe he was guilty of exalting himself a bit or seeing himself a little too good. You know, there's a proverb that says, "Let another praise you and not your own lips." There are a lot of people in our world would do well to remember that. But by the time God intervenes, Job is ready to listen. And the three friends are chastised at the end. God chastised Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, the three older friends. He said nothing to Elihu. There was a purpose in it all. Job couldn't see it immediately. Why God allowed Satan to do these things, we don't told at first. Job wasn't told at first. But we see it in the end of the story in chapter 42, and so did Job. He moved from saying, "I wish I were dead," or "I wish I'd never been born," to saying, "God is the only one with the answers, and I can't imagine what I was thinking." And the file folder was renamed. Now it said, "How the World Works," not "How I Tell Myself the Way the World Works." Is it possible that Satan himself would try to dishearten or discourage you or me? Well, of course it is. Maybe even try to use this situation of the last year and a half or others' situations or trials or circumstances we find ourselves. Of course he can. He's not above that. He doesn't have scruples to prevent that. Maybe not as dramatically as Job experienced, but it's certainly possible. Question is, are you and I learning the lessons that Job did in the way that he did? I think sometimes we open that book with the predisposed assumption, "Well, I know he was really a self-righteous guy, so nothing I can learn from that because I'm sure not like that." Maybe we should keep reading. Are there other lessons that are specific to our lives? Turn to Romans chapter 8, verse 28. This is a familiar verse for me. It's inscribed on my father's tombstone. Verse 26 of Romans 8 says, "Likewise, the Spirit also helps in our weaknesses. For we do not know what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered." You ever find you just can't seem to come up with the right words even in prayer? Don't worry about it. If you're making an effort to communicate, he knows what you're trying to say. "Now he who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is." He knows. "Because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." There are three things in that verse we need to be sure we know. The first one is to understand what it means when it says all things work together for good. It does not mean that everything that happens is good. We're talking about a pattern of life. All things work together for good. Was what happened to Job good? No, it wasn't. It was awful. It was a terrible trial. Did it work together for good? Read chapter 42. The answer is yes. You might say, what about those children of his? Well, they will be raised in the second resurrection. I know you might say, well, that's a cop-out. No, it's not. It's the whole picture. There's a difference. There's a difference. The third and second, third things are the two qualifiers. To A, those who love God, and that has to be real. That has to be based on understanding. That means you have to embrace what his purposes are. You have to embrace his plan. You have to be in full agreement with what he has laid out in his word. We can't be asking, is God fair? We have to say, I may not have answers yet, but I trust that I will. And then secondly, to those who are the called according to his purpose. God is not working in the lives of those not yet called in that way just yet. He will. And there will come a time when Romans 8:28 applies to the vast majority of humans who've ever lived. The only exceptions will be those who choose to reject him. And that will have to be an active choice. Otherwise, this will apply at some point in his perfect timing. This is a promise from God to humble ourselves before him and seek his relief and guidance. You know, Isaiah 66 verses 1 and 2 is still in the Bible. You know, where God starts out by saying, where's the house that you would build me? Where is all the good stuff you're going to do for me? He said, don't you understand? The heavens are my throne and the earth is my footstool. If you really want to impress me, if you want to catch my attention, if you want to know what I take note of, to this person will I look, to the one who trembles at my word and is of a contrite spirit. Humility catches God's eye. Maybe because it's somewhat rare in our world. Catches his eye. You know, we need to remember what he asks of us. I think of the two occasions where Jesus Christ fed the multitudes. One of them is in Matthew 14. Turn back to Matthew 14. The first part of the chapter talks about the murder of John the Baptist, because that's what it was. And when Christ heard about it, of course he was saddened, but he knew. The disciples buried John's body in verse 12 and then verse 13. When Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. What was he doing? Well, I don't know, it doesn't say, but I can offer a guess. I suspect he was grieving. John was a relative of his through his mother's line, and he was a righteous man. I suspect he was grieving. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them. That tells you something of what his mindset already was, doesn't it? And he healed their sick. When it was evening, his disciples came to him saying, this is a deserted place and the hour is already late. Send the multitudes away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food. They were concerned for people's, you know, their physical needs. It was a pretty large crowd, as we're going to find out in a moment. Jesus said they don't need to go away. Have you ever had somebody tell you something that just shoop, goes over your head, say, I can't figure that out at all? Now this is, we're leading into it, and it's coming up. You watch for it. They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. How many people were here? We're told later on. Can you imagine the disciples looking around and saying, you give them something to eat. How big do you think our knapsacks are? The nearest drive-through hamburger place is miles away. They said to him, "We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. Remember that statement. He said, "Bring them here to me." Then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass, and he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. I don't think any of us have a refrigerator that big for that many leftovers. Now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men besides women and children. Who knows how many were in this group? 15,000? 20? I don't know. We don't know. Do you wonder that the disciples said, "We've got 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. What are you talking about?" But there's something in here that we need to think about and see. Do you catch the connection to Isaiah 66? God's power and our resultant requested humility. Ask yourself a question. How many loaves and fish did Jesus Christ need to perform this miracle? You ever thought of it that way? What if, for example, they'd only had 4 loaves of bread and 1 fish? Would Jesus have said, "Well, jig's up. I can't work with this. 4 loaves, 1 fish. I need at least 1 more loaf of bread and 1 more fish. That's not what it was it? How many did he need to perform a miracle? None. 0. Nada. Zip. Zilch. The empty set. You know. He didn't need any. So why did he ask them the question? Was it because he needed an answer, or because they needed to understand something? I think it was because they needed to understand something. What did he tell them? He said, "Bring them to me." It was for their sake. You know, even visually, can you imagine the disciples in their mind's eye seeing later on the visual picture, setting out the 5 loaves of bread beside each other and the 2 little fish right beside? It could have been huge, big fish. I don't care. It doesn't matter. It might have been a 1-pound bass or, you know, a 12-pound northern pike. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Do they have northern pike in the Sea of Galilee? Probably not. But can you imagine the mental image in their minds that would stay there for the rest of their lives? 5 loaves and 2 fish. 12 baskets taken up afterwards. It was for them to understand something. Remember, brethren, we serve a God, though, who asks for all the loaves and fish. He didn't say, "Well, give me one loaf of bread. That's all I need. Give me 1 loaf and one fish. That's good. Give me the smaller one. Doesn't matter." No, he didn't do that. There was something in that too when he said, "Give me everything you have." Everything you have. Isn't that what he's telling us in our lives? Give me everything you have. Are we willing to do that? Not because he needs it, but because we do. We serve a God who asks for all the loaves and fish. We must hold nothing back. Nothing. No matter how paltry, no matter how small, no matter how insignificant. Remember that when we experience times as prophesied, when Satan will try to wear out God's own. Just remember from that chapter in Daniel that as you read the rest of the chapter, it says the court was seated and the judgment was made. And the judgment was made in favor of the saints, it says. Don't forget that part. We are his children in training, and the saints, according to Daniel 7, will take the kingdom. The fall festival season we just kept reminds us of that every year. That's what the book says. Is it any wonder Satan tries to discourage us? Guess who gets deposed as the God of this world? He even tried to get at Jesus Christ. There's a reference in Luke 4 to the temptation. We usually go to Matthew 4. But in Luke 4, it talks about that after Satan was basically banished and thrown out by Jesus Christ, told to leave, there's an interesting statement in Luke 4:13. It says, "Now when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time." Luke 4:13. Do you think he ever stopped trying to destroy Jesus? I don't think he did. He departed until an opportune time, and he may have thought he had found one, which only led to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, his burial, his 3 days and three nights in the grave, and then his resurrection. It all so horribly backfired on Satan, didn't it? So horribly backfired. He ended up advancing God's plan without apparently fully realizing it, just as he did with Job. He's a brilliant but twisted genius, but he has some blocks to his understanding. And that's something we can be grateful for. If we can remember those lessons and stay close to God, Satan's attempts can backfire when we're tested too. Looking back at Job's case, God allowed Satan more reign than we can even imagine. But in a way, again, God allowed it for reasons Job couldn't understand at the time, and I dare say we wouldn't either. But Jesus Christ showed us the way. He overcame Satan's subtle and insidious attempts. He did not give in, and we don't have to either. That's my main focus today. There is a being who will try to trip us up. We don't have to fall for it. We have to stay close to God. We have to make sure that we're pointed the right direction in our lives. We have to ask for the help, and we have to give him everything we have. Everything we have, and then wait for the miracle. Wait for the miracle. There are other areas where trials come from, or sort of discouragement comes from, and I've just tipped my hand. The second one would be trials. Trials are discouraging. But you know, think about something that Paul told the Ephesians. In Ephesians 2 and verse 19, writing to a church that he was working with, Ephesians 2 and verse 19, he was reminding them that they were, as he says in 19, "You are no longer strangers and foreigners," they were mostly Gentiles by birth, "but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are also being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." Let me ask you a question. Do you think God will allow any inferior building materials in his temple? And don't you think if we lived a life of nothing but ease and comfort and no challenges and no efforts and no trials, don't you think we would be some rather poor materials for his temple? Trials challenge us. They can be discouraging, but they can be risen above with God's help. They can help build his character. They can help perfect the building materials for the temple of God. They're not easy. Read the entire letter of 1 Peter. He focuses on that. He focuses on that, some of those things. And he also reminds us that we are not alone. But he says something in 1 Peter 4, 12 to 14 that we're very familiar with, but we need to remind ourselves from time to time. Because we get down from trials and challenges and difficulties, and it hurts. But he says, "Beloved," 1 Peter 4, 12, "don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you." And yet we do, don't we? All too often. Why is this happening? Why me? One sweet lady of, let's say, an advanced age many years ago, when I tried to visit her and encourage her in difficult time and health, and she said, "You know, people say that, but," she says, "I don't understand. Why not me? Why should I be exempt from trials? Why should I be get a pass?" What an attitude. What an attitude. Don't think it's strange. Rejoice to the extent, You might say, okay, limit that in extent. To the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, you find joy in that somehow. Rejoice, knowing what's being accomplished. When his glory is revealed, you will be glad with exceeding joy. If you reproach for his name, you're blessed. The spirit of glory and of God rests on you. On their part, he may be blasphemed, but on your part, he's glorified. And then he basically goes on to say, don't mess it up yourself. Don't make your own problems. In the verses 15 and 16 and 17. So trials are challenging. Of course they are. Hebrews, we read in Hebrews 12 some familiar verses about the whole chapter talks about responding to challenges and responding even to correction from God. It reminds us in the first two verses of Hebrews 12 that Jesus Christ was the example, that we have a race to run, that sin easily ensnares us, and we need to keep moving beyond it and outrun it. Looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despised the shame, he's sitting at the right hand of God. Then he says, consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself. He was the only one without sin. Lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. That's what we're talking about today. Being worn out, being wearied, and being discouraged. Everybody feels it. But look at where we are to turn to battle past it. Remember what Christ went through. That at this point, it's way in the future in some ways, but at this point, the next festival on the calendar is Passover, isn't it? The next annual festival. Of course, we're talking it's 6 months away, but we will get there. It'll be a little later on the Roman calendar next year because this year in the Hebrew is the leap year, the intercalary year with an extra month. Otherwise, we'd be keeping the feast in August next year, and it's just not going to happen that way. So, Paul tells us things about trials, too, that ought to encourage us. Remember 1 Corinthians 10, where he reminds us that nothing has happened to us that's uncommon, and he says there will be a way around it. You will never be tested beyond what you are capable of enduring. I know we've probably all gone to God in prayer and say, things, thank you for thinking I'm so strong. I don't think I'm that strong, but you've allowed this trial, so I must be able to deal with it. That's the truth. Must we succumb to the temptations to sin? That's up to us. And therein lies a third challenge for discouragement. Our own sins and poor choices. Yes, that's a factor. That's a factor. James wrote about it in James chapter 1. Just explaining something. He said in James 1:12, he said, blessed is the man who endures temptation, not caves into it. For when he's been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. We've got to keep focused on the end result. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm tempted by God, or ask, is God fair? For God can't be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. He doesn't operate that way. He is not that small-minded. Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. That's where the problem is. If God allows things to come in front of us, we should still learn to resist. It's not an easy pill to swallow. We don't want to admit sometimes that we cause our own problems, but sometimes we do. It's that simple. Think back to the national example of Israel. Who was their worst enemy? Was it Pharaoh? God took care of Pharaoh. Was it the Egyptian army? They drowned in the Red Sea. Who was their worst enemy? They were. Because God took care of the outer threats. The external threats. The internal ones were the problem. What did Moses tell them when they felt like they were trapped between the army and the mountains and the sea? He basically said, stop complaining, go forward. And that's when the way opened up through the Red Sea. It wasn't visible to them, but God provided a way. There's a proverb in chapter 24 and verse 10 that says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Whose strength do we want to rely on? Remember the point from earlier in the sermon? We serve a God who asks us to give all that we have. How many loaves and fish do you have? What's God's answer? Bring them here. Bring them to me. He asked for it all. A fourth area would be lack of faith, and this one's actually tied up very closely with the last point, our own sins. Why is that? Well, because of one of the biblical definitions of sin in Romans chapter 14. There are actually three in the New Testament, not just the one that we're so familiar with, 1 John 3:4. But in Romans 14, which deals with the subject of meat offered to idols, not exactly a deal breaker in our world, but it was back then. And finally, as he sums it up, Paul says in verse 22, "Do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he doesn't eat from faith. And here's why. Whatever is not from faith is sin." That's another New Testament definition of sin. It must proceed from faith, from belief. This is how God is working. This is what I have to do. If you violate that and violate your conscience, your sense of what is right and wrong that God implanted in humans, I believe, you damage your character. That's why it's sin. It's not as explicit a definition as 1 John 3:4, but it serves. It adds a dimension to it. You know, one of the most encouraging, there are both positive and negative examples in the Bible. One of the most encouraging is the example of Joshua. Go back and reread the first several chapters of Joshua, the whole book actually. And look at what he went through. Moses had died. Moses was unique. He was still unique in the New Testament. The Pharisees and Sadducees continually referred to what Moses taught them. He was an outstanding servant of God. He was special. But he was also human, and part of his humanness prevented him from going into the promised land, didn't it? And Joshua had it all fall on him like a load of bricks. And he wasn't all that young when you look into the details. He was probably a sprightly young guy of about 80 when he took over. Somewhere 60 to 80. Because if he was allowed to enter the promised land, he had to have been at least in his 60s. Probably more. He was already known as a leader in those early days when they left Egypt. He might have been 80 years old. Young guy. And he was encouraged by God. He was bold. He went up to a stranger and he said, "Who are you?" And the answer was, "I am the commander of the armies of the Eternal." That'd give you kind of a jolt, but also a little bit of courage. Read through his example. He had total faith. What kind of a legacy did he leave? By the end of his life, we're told in the last chapter that after he died, that an entire generation of the elders who overlived him kept the nation on track. For an entire series of lifetimes of other leaders, they still were okay because of his strong example. There's a parable in Luke chapter 18 that also sheds a little bit of light on this. Luke 18. We'll start to wind things up here. Luke 18. And verse 1. That's not where I'm looking, is it? Nope. I'm in John. Probably why I'm not finding it. Strange how that happened. I just got new glasses yesterday. And I can see all 174 of you out there right now. Luke 18. Ah, that looks better. Then he spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. Isn't that what we're talking about today? Dishearten is one of the synonyms for discourage. Saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, 'Get justice for me from my adversary.'" It's a word that's often used to describe Satan, so that's pretty strong language. "And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, 'Though I do not fear God nor regard man, Yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. He said, there's a lesson in this. That's what Jesus did. He taught lessons by parables. Not to the crowds. They didn't understand. The parables were for his disciples. And shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, although he bears long with them? Sometimes the answers are longer than we'd like to think they should be. But the folder says, how I tell myself the world works, remember? We want it to say how the world works. I tell you, he will avenge them speedily, by his definition of speedily. His definition is different from ours. You think you have a car that can reach whatever speed you want it to go? How long did it take Jesus Christ to ascend to his Father's throne after he was resurrected? How far away is the third heaven? How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You see what? He didn't travel at the speed of light. That would have taken centuries, millennia. He traveled at the speed of thought. He was there and he was back. Speedily to God means something different than it does to us. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? That's a disturbing question. You know what we need to learn from this parable? It really is a parable. That's what it says. What was the purpose of it? He spoke a parable to them, his disciples. Here was the point they needed to learn, that men always ought to pray and not get discouraged. Isn't that what it says? And not lose heart. That's not easy. But it is what he asks of us. He says, trust me. Know that I have your best interests at heart. Know that I have the end of the road in my viewfinder. Know that you're headed that way. Sometimes, brethren, we don't ever understand everything fully. A couple of years ago, we had a tragedy that hit our extended family. With the death, sudden death, some kind of a heart issue, of our daughter-in-law's uncle, Nathan Fultz. Some of you knew the name. 50 years old. Wife, 4 children. Gone. At his funeral service, his pastor, Tom Clark, said something I will never forget. Tom Clark said, there are questions for which we have no answers today. There are questions for which we have no answers today. We have a lot more than today to find out the answers. And that's the beauty of God's plan. Remember what I kept asking you last week in the sermon? Remember the key word? Focus. 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 Where's our vision? Think back to the beginning of the sermon, discouragement, all those other 35 words, plus the definition I threw out at you. I expect you to remember them all by next week. Those things are all around us in this world. Now is no exception. It may be one of the prime times for it, but our world has been filled with these things. We come back to Christ's own words and his own teaching and his own parables, like this one, Luke 18. Look at so many parables, Matthew 13, Matthew 20, so whole sections of them. He was teaching his disciples, not the world. They didn't understand. The world didn't get it at all. He had to explain that to them too. The world is blinded. They don't understand God's plan yet. They will. That's the beauty of it. Someday. And one day, which is also pictured in the recently completed Fall Holy Days, that archenemy will be restrained. He will be imprisoned. It does say in Revelation 20, a puzzler, he must be released at the end of the 1,000 years. I spoke about that at the feast. Mr. Slagle sort of touched on a few themes I spoke about in that sermon too. He must be released. Why? Well, we don't know. fully. We can sort of see what happens as a result, maybe piece together possibilities, but we have to trust. This is the answer. Remember the lesson from the feeding of the 5,000. We serve a God who asks for all we have. And then He makes up the difference. Are you and I all in?